And welcome to this episode of Ann Arbor AF, a podcast for folks trying to figure out what's going on in Ann Arbor. We discuss current events in local politics and policy, governance, and other civic good times. I'm Molly Kleinman, and my pronouns are she, her.
I'm Michelle Hughes, and my pronouns are she, her.
And I'm Jess Lita, and my pronouns are she, her.
We are your co-hosts to help you get informed and get involved. It's your city. Let's jump in.
Today, we're talking about the next city council meeting coming up Tuesday, September 7th. We'll be touching on a few interesting agenda items, including dark sky, DEI, and our forever fave, sidewalks, and offer some ways for you to get involved. A quick process note, we record this a few days before the council meeting, which means there will likely be some changes to the agenda between now and then. Jumping right into the consent agenda, I saw an opportunity to do a little civic education training. CA13 is a resolution to approve a certain amount of money that in even today's consent agenda is by far not the greatest amount of dollars, but it does require 8 votes, and I just wanted to name why. This particular consent agenda item requests the ability to draw funds from the water supply system fund balance. Now, for those of you Uber geeks who were paying attention to the budget episode all the way back in, I don't know, February, I think. It feels like 5 years ago at this point. But when we did the budget episode, we talked about fund balances. And essentially, those are savings accounts for those specific funds. So the water supply system has its own fund. Its fund balance is a savings account. And so 8 votes are required because we're pulling from a different, essentially, line item in the budget than we normally do. And now you have been civically educated. I also wanted
What are they pulling the money out of the savings account for?
I didn't even pay attention to that part because it was just in the middle of a bunch of construction contracts, and that was the only one that required 8 votes. So I don't know, Michelle. Good question.
CA13, that is.
Mm-hmm.
It says it's a services agreement with ATC Group Services LLC for environmental services at 2000 South Industrial Highway. That's probably all we need to know for now. I don't know.
That's right. That's right.
It seems pretty routine.
It is fairly routine. And even though $60,000 is a lot of dollars when it comes to the city, that's a fairly routine amount of money to spend.
Right. We're spending it from the money that we were supposed to spend it on this sort of thing, and we're spending it on that sort of thing. So everything seems normal.
Exactly. It seems kosher. Now, I'm interested if the new city charter amendment proposal passes, the one that says no contract amounts below, I think they said $75,000 will come to council. I'm curious if that's also true for fund balances. My guess is that it's not, because a fund balance request is actually technically a different kind of budget request, but that will be, again, a civic education tidbit for us when we get to that point. Yeah. Speaking of civic education, CA14. All right, this one I will read the full title because it gets really fun really quickly. This is the resolution to endorse the reallocation of funds within the general fund to support a more robust, diverse diversity, equity, and inclusion program in the city of Ann Arbor. So important to note in this right off the bat is that this is not requesting new dollars, and that this resolution comes from staff. In fact, I'll read it off because I thought it was cute. This was prepared by John Fournier, acting city administrator, reviewed by John Fournier, acting city administrator, and approved by John Fournier, acting city administrator. Mm-hmm. So this is staff originated. It's not a council resolution. And the reason that I find that interesting is because this means that this is an expression of work that has already had council support. Council, if you remember, did a budget resolution in, I think it's June of this year, you guys, that supported the creation of a DEI office and position.
Diversity, equity, and inclusion.
Thank you, Michelle. I appreciate that. And I don't actually remember if it was DEI or if it was specific to racial equity. That's how the Washtenaw County office is set up.
Yeah, this one's DEI.
This one's DEI. Okay, thank you. So, yeah, this is also a much better way of getting at this work. There was a really problematic resolution pertaining to DEI earlier this year, and it was a council originated resolution requesting a DEI diversity, equity, and inclusion specialist within the community engagement office. The problem was the language was so problematic that it felt deeply uninformed by actual DEI work. And even the goals of that resolution were fairly unclear. So having this position come out of a DEI office, and as I said, policy supported, DEI policy that's already been supported by council, this feels like an expression of and a continuation of work rather than kind of starting something from scratch.
Yeah, so the thing that happened in June was that they put it in the budget to hire a person whose job was to specifically focus on DEI, and they would work directly under the city administrator. That's how the org chart worked. And then this thing on the budget, or this thing today, it doesn't change the budget, but it moves a community engagement specialist out from deep in the bowels of the city's org chart to work directly with the DEI office. And so it's like, you know, kind of an acknowledgement, I think, that the city needs to, when it does its community engagement, it can't just like be like, you know, put out a thing on the city website that only the Uber nerds look at, and then only the, like, you know, only the same people come to talk about the city all the time. That it needs to, that community engagement really needs to be more about outreach and really needs to be more about including people that, you know, are, that need to be included, including everybody that needs to be included.
Right. And then
I like this.
Go ahead, Molly.
I think one way to think about this, so council decided to create this sort of high level DEI coordinator role, but it was just one person. And so this essentially doubles the size of the, you can think of it as doubling the size of the DEI office, because now that person who we still have not hired, and my understanding is that I think that role was actually being rewritten. So it had been posted at a lower level than people were expecting with a lower salary, and that's being revised to be a higher level role. And then this role will go under it. So again, yeah, moving things around, but moving things in a way that gives more resources explicitly to the work of diversity, equity, and inclusion in the city, which I think is great.
And the analog to this is under OSI, which is the Office of Sustainability and Innovation, Director Missy Stultz recently hired somebody to be a liaison to the building department. So instead of having somebody whose sole expertise is sustainable buildings under the building department and therefore kind of siloed, we have a buildings person within the sustainability office who can be a liaison to community engagement, to public safety, to climate justice, to the other kinds of work that OSI is doing. And I have to say, in not my Ann Arbor AF role, but wearing a different hat, I've had the opportunity to interact with this liaison person. It is profoundly effective and super helpful to have somebody whose whole job is to talk to multiple departments. The city staff, from what I gather, have a generally pretty congenial relationships with each other, but there's still siloing, right? Like there are departments, and it can be easy to not look beyond your desk or the desk of the person next to you, euphemistically speaking, in a pandemic. But having somebody whose job is a liaison, but with an anchor in that goal that we're trying to reach, whether it's sustainability or diversity, equity, inclusion, feels like an extra powerful way to leverage these dollars.
I like it.
And one other thing that I wanted to say that isn't in the resolution, but that we saw in the news this last week, is that interim city administrator John Fournier also has done an analysis of staff pay and is taking the initiative to increase the pay, not give raises, but increase the pay to equitable levels for a number of staff who are either women, people of color, or both. So it's really nice to see this kind of work being proactively adopted by staff and really gone after. So yay, CDV Ann Arbor, good job.
I like it.
And those raises, those raises are going to people who were, whose salaries were below market rate for their roles, right? So it's specific. Yes. It was like very specifically an equity review of salaries, and
yes,
and that's the result exactly. is some increases.
Yep. Thanks for clarifying. I think that's everything that I had to say about this for right now, although I don't promise that something won't come to me later. We get to talk about Sky next.
Yes, there is a, this is the second reading, so there's a public hearing about it, and there's a new ordinance coming out that is about outdoor lighting. And so there's a public hearing, PH1, and this is an ordinance that would affect what people are allowed to install on their own property when they're installing outdoor lighting. And it requires the lighting that they install to be dark sky friendly. So it's supposed to not be just like barfing light up into the sky, where it stops us from seeing the stars and, you know, does it, what we call light pollution, where the light, you know, the sky gets brighter in the nighttime. This apparently has bad effects for the environment. I was just thinking of it in terms of like, that I like the idea of having a dark sky just so I can look at the stars and we can, you know, people can do astronomy and stuff like that. But like, it apparently is also good for habitats and the environment and animals in some way. Jess, I think you know more about that.
Just a tidbit. Yeah. So I love thinking about our non-human neighbors and how we can be nice neighbors to them. And birds, bugs, bats, those are the first three that I can think of really rely on patterns of illumination to kind of dictate their behavior. Birds, bats in particular, I think more than any of them, get really confused by nighttime illumination and their kind of interaction with bugs and what they do to keep our ecosystem safe and healthy really gets kind of disrupted with nighttime illumination. The same thing for birds. Birds are made to fly. The ones that fly in the dark are made to fly in the dark. And having that nighttime illumination, again, really disrupts their ability to keep themselves safe. Same for like big windows in glass buildings, but that's a separate thing. So dark skies help our bird, bat, and bug neighbors too.
And another thing I wanted to say about this is that like, we can achieve a dark sky without having a dark environment that we walk in. Like, we're not asking that people don't install outdoor lighting. We're asking that people install outdoor lighting that faces downward instead of upward. And if, exactly, as long as you like put a little hat on the light, you know, that kind of thing. It's like, we used to have this, some of our oldest streetlights in the city are these globes. And it's just like 50% of that light is just going straight up into the sky for no reason other than to make the sky, you know, it's not doing anything to help anyone. It's just producing light pollution.
So. And that's true. I am curious about those fixtures, if it's possible. So first of all, Michelle, I want you to come to all architecture review meetings with me from now on, because I need us to be able to talk about barfing light and hats on sconces. Like, this is awesome. So I'm curious, can we take those fixtures and just put hats on them? Like, do we have to do a wholesale replacement, or can we just, you know, put little hats on the fixtures? I'm curious, and I don't know.
I think all the ones that are left that are like that aren't actually city ones, they're university ones. I'm not sure about that.
Main Street has full globes, I know.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, anyway, and this, I think, doesn't affect, was there already a city policy about replacing city-owned ones? Because like this is about this affects private lighting.
I think so. I guess I can't speak for the city, but I know the DDA has a practice in our new projects of making sure that all our fixtures are dark sky friendly universally, and to the extent that they can be, they're pedestrian scaled. So we're not trying to light the landscape. We're trying to light the area that people on the street need to move.
Yeah. So anyway, this is a public hearing. I might call in and encourage them to pass it, although I don't think that's going to be an issue. Let's move on to, oh, me. Ha! Okay. There's another public hearing going on, public hearing 2, which is the same as on the agenda B2, and it's about home occupations. And we have an ordinance that, so when we do zoning, we say what uses a parcel can be put towards. And when we say that something is residentially zoned, that means you can't, you know, do commercial operation out of there. And They want to they want people to be able to use, their home as a business within reason. And then, so we have this thing that says home occupations, that even if your parcel is zoned residential and not commercial, you can still do some commercial occupations in there under certain circumstances. And this is an attempt to liberalize that and make it, there was previously a bunch of restrictions on what you could do as a home occupation. And this adds some more things you can do, but I think it doesn't go quite far enough in liberalizing it. There's some real specific things in it that are troubling. Like it asks that things that you are storing on your property for your business, you have to store it like out of sight. It can't be outside of the building. It has to be inside your garage or whatever. And that doesn't seem like a particularly reasonable thing to me. There's limitations on the number of visitors you can have at like the total number of visitors you can have, but then there's also a limit on the number of visitors you can have at any given time. And those don't seem entirely reasonable. And then there's some like nuisance ordinance type stuff that like we already have noise ordinances and like, other types of nuisance ordinances, but then for some reason, this adds additional restrictions. If you're doing the same thing, you can't be quite as loud. You can't be quite as smelly or whatever if you're making money doing the thing. And I don't see why we would have to, if we don't like these nuisances, I don't see why we're making that distinction between something that's being done for money and something that's being done as a hobby, And then I also wanted to call out Scott Trudeau's blog, which is where I read his analysis on this stuff. He's somebody that was on the planning commission for a bunch of years, but he's not anymore. But now he writes a little blog about things like this when they turn up. And we're going to have a link to that in the description.
He does a nice job in his analysis of calling out how a lot of his criticisms about the ordinance as it's being brought forward is that it's classist, and that really breeds. So his argument is interesting. And as Michelle said, there'll be a link in the show notes if you want to check it out.
Right. And I mean, I think, I like the idea of liberalizing it. I'm not going to say don't pass this one. I'm going to say pass this one and then continue to figure out more ways to liberalize it. And, in the future. I'm going to kick it over to Molly now.
Yes. So I'm going to talk about C1, it's an ordinance to amend the traffic code. And specifically it's about personal mobility vehicles. So this is the very long awaited update to the traffic code to include e-scooters and other, people call them personal mobility vehicles or micro mobility, but whatever we want to call those things, include them in the road rules of the city. They're already on our streets. They're already being used. This is to codify that and make it clear so everyone knows what we're doing. I was on the committee that worked on this. This is a three-year-old thing at this point. It took, there was a pandemic in the middle. The legal department had some higher priorities than this one.
The first time I ever met Molly was when I actually just randomly showed up at this meeting, and I was a boy back then. That's how long this has been in process.
it's been a long time. And so the committee included myself, a member of the city's Disability Commission, Jim Summers, who's on the Transportation Commission, it's so long ago that he was not on the commission when we started working on this, but he was then and is still the owner of the local e-bike shop and has a lot of experience with the sort of technical specifications around e-bikes, which was really valuable as we were doing this work. And Scott Trudeau, who was formerly on both the Planning and Transportation Commissions, and then also city staff, including a representative from the police department, because there were questions about enforceability around some of these things we talked about regulating. So the key things to know about this revision is that it permits personal mobility vehicles in both bike lanes and on sidewalks, which is what our current regulations do for bikes. So in Ann Arbor, bikes are allowed in the street and on the sidewalk. That's not true everywhere in this country, but it's true in Ann Arbor. And so rather than change that in any way, we just bundled in these other kinds of vehicles as also being allowed in both places. We essentially, there are some revisions to the code, but essentially anywhere that used to say bicycle now says personal mobility vehicle. The definition of what a personal mobility vehicle is took a lot of care and consideration. We went through a lot of iterations of this definition because we wanted to be really sure that we weren't unintentionally excluding vehicles that we meant to include. We wanted it to be really inclusive. So I'm going to read you the new definition. Any vehicle intended to carry no more than two persons abreast that is not a motor vehicle or trailer required to be licensed or registered by the state of Michigan, that is propelled either by the power of a person riding or by the power of a person riding in combination with a single or multiple electric motors. Some things that we talked about that did not end up in this definition were regulating the size or power of the motors. We decided not to do that. Regulating the speed that it could go. We decided not to do that. The whole thing about no more than two persons abreast is in there because at first the city came to us with one person abreast. And I was like, well, does that mean cargo bikes that put two kids next to each other in the lane are not allowed? Are we trying to make sure that those little pedicabs that we see on game days, are we saying those aren't allowed? So I think when someone is looking at this for the first time, there's a lot of like, well, what about this? And did you think about engine size? And it's like, we did. We thought about all those things. And we really wanted to be as inclusive as possible so that technologies that don't exist yet will also be included in this. We didn't want to have to rewrite this every time some new invention comes along that allows people to move through space in a way that's kind of like a bike allows them to move through space. So I feel really good about this revision as it's come forward. I think it should probably be an easy unanimous vote, but I also think it's very likely that council members are going to start out by asking or suggesting some of these things that we already went through in the committee. So if you are watching the meeting and they say, well, did they think about this? And why doesn't it mention that? Like, I promise we thought about it like at least once and possibly three times. But it's like this, what's coming forward is really intentional about not creating major upheaval. This is really not a big change to any of our rules. It's just trying to expand the way we define things that are allowed in bike lanes.
So Molly, I have a question, and I get that this work for you is a little bit stale. So,
it's fine.
If you haven't prepared for this quiz, that's fine. But I remember when Birds landed at the rentable scooters for the very first time in Ann Arbor a few years ago, one of the things that was bandied about at the time was the state law regarding where scooters were allowed to be. And I'm just curious how this ordinance interacts with or doesn't interact with the state law.
So my recollection is that the state law was specifically and exclusively about electric skateboards, and it didn't cover these scooters. And so that was part of the challenge. The state law is very clear that electric skateboards are allowed in the road. So this includes electric skateboards in the definition of a personal mobility device. So it's not in conflict with the state law. It permits e-skateboards in the same places that the state permits them, basically.
That's helpful. Thanks.
Yeah. I don't know why the state like took it upon themselves to specifically legalize electric skateboards. I'm really curious about how, like, who brought that forward? How, like, usually Michigan is not known for considering alternative transportation modes that are not cars. And so I'd love to know how that happened. That's the personal mobility vehicle ordinance. And next I'm going to hand it back to Michelle.
And I'm going to talk about public power utility. That is something that I'm excited about. I've been excited about that for a while. And I think it used to be people who were excited about it were people who were like, in the Democratic Socialists and people who like figured that taking over DTE was the only way to ensure that they would do things that We're in line with our climate goals, things like that. But now that we've had some big power disruptions in the storms in the last month or so, I think there's now a broader appeal to the public utility thing. And so basically, like, the idea of the public utility is that rather than having DTE provide power and the city legislates that they are a monopoly, and if you want to buy electricity, you have to buy it from DTE, that the city would then become the provider of that power, just like how you have when you buy water, you're buying it from the city's public utility rather than from a private company that's bringing you water. And so in places like Lansing, they have a municipal authority called the Board of Water and Light that provides power and water. But the thing is, they've had it since power was invented. And so it's a little bit of a different process to kind of take the infrastructure that is already owned by a private utility and make it public. And but it's something that state laws allow. In some states, it's harder to do, but in Michigan, it's not hard to do. And the city could make these utility public if we wanted to. And it would involve things like buying up the utility poles. The city would have to buy up the utility poles and take responsibility for maintaining the power lines, things like that. And it doesn't especially have to involve us actually buying the means to generate power, because I think, you know, there's a big power grid, and our utility could just buy power from the power grid that's put on there by whoever. So the power plants may still be owned by DTE, but even if we bought up the utility poles and things like that. But I think that there is some hope among people in town that a public utility that's interested in serving the public rather than making a profit might be more interested in proactive maintenance and fixing problems when they happen. And people who have just spent, you know, a week without power and going to emergency cooling stations at Pioneer High School and things like that are thinking, maybe somebody could do this better, and maybe that's us. So this would obviously be a big step, and it would be a lot to do, and it would cost a lot of money for us to buy these utility poles and things like that. And so that's not what's on the agenda on Tuesday. Instead, what's on the agenda on Tuesday is a question about creating a feasibility study to consider the feasibility of doing a public power utility. And the Energy Commission has previously heard a presentation about this from a local organization called the Ann Arbor for Public Power. And it seems like the feasibility study would cost $120,000. And this resolution that's on the agenda here is DC1. It doesn't even ask the city to spend $120,000 on a feasibility study. It's kind of roundabout, and I kind of don't understand why the resolution is written in this way, but this resolution asks the Energy Commission to please consider a feasibility study at their September 14th meeting, and then please give a recommendation that yes, the city should pursue a feasibility study so that the city can get it on the September 20th agenda, so that then the city can consider whether to have a feasibility study. And I kind of wonder, like, if we already foregone, you know, if we already have a foregone conclusion about what the answer should be, why are we even asking the Energy Commission? Why not just have the city put it on staff's agenda?
And I mean, there's this. Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
Like, we're asking them to do this on their September 14th agenda. It's not like they have a whole lot of like legwork that they can do between now and then to like make a more robust resolution. But sorry, what were you saying, Molly?
So there's this history of referring things to commissions in order to give them more legitimacy before they come back to council for a vote, like something that will originate with council, but they sort of sending it to a commission is sort of a way of getting some quote unquote public input to sort of validate whatever the thing is that they want to do. So we had some issues on Transportation Commission of things getting referred to transportation. And then the city, and then want them sort of like wanting a quick response, and it didn't always work with our schedule or our agendas. And so then there were some issues around that. I think that happened at some point with the snow removal stuff, and there've been some other ones as well. So I'm sort of assuming that this is about like this, you know, this came from a council member in response to like current events, basically, but they want to get that legitimacy of having it go through a commission, but they want it to happen quickly. And so they're trying to make it happen really fast. I don't know how Energy Commission works, but like once the agenda is like, we can't usually add things that close to a meeting for a Transportation Commission agenda. That's like, it's too disruptive. We have everything planned out. These are all volunteers. So I don't know if that will actually play out with the timing that this requests.
Yeah. So I kind of don't know, like at that timeline, like what meaningful things could the Energy Commission do? It's not like they're going to like, you know, go and do a whole bunch of research between now and September 14th, if they hadn't been doing it beforehand, you know?
No, it's about conferring legitimacy rather than about like actual, that's my guess anyway.
Yeah. That's what it seems like. And I just feel like, you know, if council want, you know, and it's, and the, this resolution actually already presupposes that the answer will be yes, we should do the feasibility study. So if council wants to do the feasibility study, just do the feasibility study. Like, that's what I think. Like, because you could, you know, council can say like, hey, staff, we want this to happen, make it happen. And, you know, even if it's not fully baked, you know, I definitely like when things are fully baked, but I also appreciate the urgency of this. And like, you know, this is something that I've been wanting to happen since it, you know, since back when it seemed like a DSA daydream, but like, you know, so I appreciate going forward with this fast. And I just wish we could just go forward with it. You know,
I do like that we are responding in a timely manner to urgent events. I will say with this one, the same thing that I've said a million times and will say a million times more. I want to know what this is rolling up to. We have a citywide policy agenda. And while this ordinance, the resolution language, does a good job of laying out the problems, especially the recent problems the last couple of months with our energy utility grid, it doesn't cite A20, it doesn't cite our sustainability plan, it doesn't cite how this interacts with our state policy agenda, which this would have something to do with. So, you know, instead of the conferring legitimacy, you know, method that Molly's talking about in terms of let's go to a commission, confer legitimacy by telling us what you've already said you want from the policy agenda and how this accomplishes it. I'm not even saying this doesn't, I'm just saying like we have a vacuum of that information and it would be nice to see it in this language.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, I don't know. I hope this passes, and but like I might suggest just going straight to the staff instead of going to Energy Commission, but that's just because I'm real excited about it. And I see that I'd like us to strike while the iron is hot. But there's other things to talk about, and I'd like Jess to do that.
Other things to talk about, like food procurement. I love when stuff showed up on the agenda and I had no idea that it was coming. Like the fur one, that was one, had no idea that one was coming. And now we've got food procurement. So this resolution, DC2, asks staff to check out if the city can buy food from the farmers market and other local growers. The language of the resolution puts forward, this one actually does roll up to a larger policy agenda. It cites A20, it cites our carbon neutrality plan, and the fact that at scale, a society can only be truly sustainable if it moves en masse towards a plant-based diet. All true. My concern with this resolution is that Ann Arbor's food procurement is actually fairly tiny. And so the actual carbon footprint of this action is going to be so small as to be negligible. In fact, I would argue that the greater impact of this resolution is more the fact that Ann Arbor would be a role model in saying this is what we're doing than that we're actually doing this so much. My bigger criticism of this is that it feels really micromanaging. As I said, it cites A20, but it's really up to staff and the whole Office of Sustainability and Innovation to implement A20 and only bring back actions to staff as it needs approval. So I'm curious why we're going after this. It feels, having asked no one any questions about this, this feels like performance over substance. This feels like I want to be able to talk about local food systems in a way that makes us all look and feel good, but that actually doesn't have it, like the numbers don't bear out that this is going to make a significant difference. And it, because it's not inconsistent with our plan, because this is a part of the plan we're already executing, like we're asking to go faster on something that just doesn't have a lot of impact. So I just wanted to bring up that I see this. It's good practice, but questionable execution, in my opinion.
And I was just kind of worried about, like, I don't think that the city has anywhere like a chef that prepares food from scratch. Like, it's not like right. We have, like, you know, like, I don't think that even at, like, I think it mentions parks facilities or something like that, but like, I don't think there's a, you know, maybe they're selling like popsicles or something like that, but I don't think there's anywhere like a chef that prepares things from scratch. So I don't think they could be buying things from the farmer's market, you know?
Right. So this may be even more about how we make decisions about how we're making catering decisions than it is about local food procurement, which again, makes me feel like this is more about how I want to talk about food than how food actually works. Also, if our city cook is not Remy from Ratatouille, then I'm just not interested. Speaking of things that are interesting, let's talk about the Racquet Club.
Good friends. All right, so here we go. This is DS1, the resolution to waive sidewalks at the Racquet Club of Ann Arbor, 3010 Hickory Lane, which also, it also fronts Getty's. So there's a rule that when certain kinds of major work is happening on a property, there's a requirement to bring certain things up to code, which can include adding sidewalks where they're missing. It can include bringing things up to ADA compliance, Americans with Disabilities Act. And so the Racquet Club of Ann Arbor is asking for that rule to be waived so that they don't have to install a sidewalk along Getty's. And this was a bit of a journey for me as I was learning about this resolution, and I'm going to bring you all along on my journey. So my first-
Hang on a second. Sorry. I wanted to add like that it's triggered by like the reason that there's even a question that they might have to add sidewalks is because they're doing some renovation on their property.
Yeah, so they're doing some renovations on the property, which is a thing they've done several times before, and I'll get to that part in a second. And so it would trigger this requirement to put in a sidewalk, and they're asking for a waiver. So my first response to a country club asking for a waiver to not put in a sidewalk was absolutely the fuck not. They're lucky that we're not expropriating their tennis courts to build housing. There is no way on earth we should let them get away with not installing a sidewalk. Like, this is very obvious to me. Country club versus sidewalk. Like, sidewalk should win always. But I took the time to actually read their petition, and it comes off as mostly reasonable. So this section of Getty's where they would need to be putting in a sidewalk, it would be particularly complicated and expensive to install. So they'd have to cut down something like 19 trees. And in general, I'm not someone who's going to prioritize a tree over a sidewalk, but 19 trees is a lot of trees to cut down. Just like logistically speaking, again, we're talking about expense. They would have to move utilities. And in this case, the work that they're doing that is triggering this requirement is like some relatively minor pool upgrades. So it's entirely possible that the sidewalk would end up costing more than the improvements that they're trying to make to the property. Furthermore, they've done a lot of other work over the years. And every time they've asked for this sidewalk waiver, previous councils have given it to them. And some of those councils were majorities that I think of as reasonable. And so, you know, I'm inclined to trust their judgment. So, you know, maybe this is okay. Like, even though it feels wrong to me, maybe we should like give them their waiver. However, we come to my third response, which is that they also say that there's no point to putting a sidewalk on Getty's here because there's no pedestrians here. And it's like, well, maybe there's no pedestrians because Getty's is a pretty busy road and there's it's no safe place.
And you will die.
Yeah, there's no safe place for them to be. So like, of course, there's a good reason to put a sidewalk on Getty's. Like Getty's is actually a pretty clear example of a road that should have sidewalks on both sides. There's a sidewalk on the other side and they think that's enough, but crossing Getty's
is not enough. It's never enough. Everyone always thinks it's enough. It's never enough.
Right. Crossing Getty's is not that safe. Furthermore, the club did a bunch of major work they talk about on their website. They're very proud of all their brand new buildings that they built in 2017. And that is probably the point at which they should have done this sidewalk. That's the point at which council should have required them to. They were doing a lot of work replacing buildings. That's when they should have done it, but council let them get away with it. And so now they have this minor pool work they want to do, and it feels a little extreme to make them do this humongous sidewalk project. But the thing is, like, eventually we need a sidewalk here. So it's like, is the plan just to never put a sidewalk here ever? Because if so, that's not a good plan, in my opinion. And it's one of these things where every exception that we make feels specific and individual in the moment. But if you add up all of those exceptions together, they become a total failure to meet our safety and climate goals. And so in this case, I feel like the question is starting to become, which is it? Vision zero or eternal country club exceptionalism? And I'm inclined to come down on the side of vision zero. I also would understand if, given the specifics of this instance, council ends up giving them another waiver, but I would sincerely hope that they would push the club pretty hard to say, like, this can't keep happening. We need a sidewalk there. And yeah, there are a bunch of trees, but maybe you put the sidewalk on the other side of the trees. Like, they have enough land there for a whole bunch of tennis courts and like all kinds of stuff. They can figure out where to put a sidewalk. This is one of those situations that's maybe a little bit more complicated than it looked to me at first, but ultimately I'm coming down on the side of sidewalks.
And this resolution, it is, yes. This resolution, I think, touches on two key tensions that keep coming up every time we talk about sidewalks, which is, are we treating sidewalks as amenities or infrastructure? Right. And whose responsibility are they? We keep making sidewalks the responsibility of individuals, and individuals are like, hey, this is infrastructure expensive. I don't want to do it. Like, and I'm not going to say enlightened, but it's rational self-interest to not want to do this. But we keep giving people the option over and over and over, and they opt into no. So my question, and I don't know if anybody here knows the answer to this, I'm just curious why the sidewalk millage isn't covering this. I thought that this is the kind of thing that was intended to solve.
Right. And my understanding is that it's because of the kind of work that they're doing. It's similar to a developer putting in something new in a location. And in Ann Arbor, when a developer puts something new in and there's no sidewalk there, they're required to put in a sidewalk at that time. And I think the same is true for these certain kinds of property improvements. And so that's my understanding as to why it's not a part of the this new sidewalk millage. And maybe that's a negotiation that happens. Maybe that's a deal that ends up getting struck where some of the money for this work comes from the millage. I'm open to some kind of flexibility, but an end result where we never get a sidewalk on that side of Getty's is unacceptable to me.
I think that if it ever got to the point where this particular stretch of sidewalk got to the top of the sidewalk gap project, then the millage would cover it.
But so it's about prioritization. That might also be
the case. Yeah. But like, yeah. So like if they want to just never make this pool, you know, this pool renovation, and they want to never make any other renovations, then they can continue waiting until the sidewalk millage covers this. But if they want to make these improvements now, they got to pay for the whole improvement. And that means the sidewalks too.
Right. But of course, given the expense of this sidewalk, if that comes to the millage, that's a bunch of other sidewalk the city can't install somewhere
exactly.
else. And so I don't love that plan, but if the city says no, you can't have a waiver, and then they they decide not to do these pool improvements, then we still end up with no sidewalk. And so I would rather see the city and the country club come to the table and figure out a solution that ends in a sidewalk. And it might not be the perfect, like, you know, sticking it to the country club man, but like, I don't care about that as much as I care about the sidewalk.
And I also wanted to make the point, you know, Michelle said sidewalks on both sides, always true. I also want to make the point that this particular location is directly across the street from a pretty active pedestrian feeder into Gallup Park. Like there are people there all the time, and there are people on the street there all the time, and they are constantly crossing, and it is horrendously unsafe because it's at the foot of a blind curve on a hill coming down from, I think, Huron Parkway. So cars are coming out of that thing at speed. And we're asking folks to cross in not a great spot to not a real sidewalk. So I just want to affirm, yes, sidewalks both sides always, also here for reasons.
Yeah, exactly.
I'd like to see us have a policy that if there's not a sidewalk, we don't let vehicles drive on that street. Pedestrians should have the right. And like, I particularly would like to see it in situations like when they're doing utility work and the sidewalk gets closed and they say, oh, well, this sidewalk is just closed, go elsewhere. Yeah. But cars, oh, come right in. And I would like to see those places just, okay, pedestrians, you use the road now, and cars, you go elsewhere, because it's so much easier for you. You just put your foot down a little bit and you've gone, you know, a mile, and you didn't even have to think about it.
Yeah. I mean, there are cities that have much better rules around maintaining pedestrian pathways during mm-hmm. construction. And I would love to see Ann Arbor get more aggressive about that. That is a thing.
Good. Since we're banging this drum, I'm going to do that too. There's a good stretch of West Liberty that's closed right now for other infrastructure improvements. I think this one is water and some street. There is a car detour. There is not a bike lane detour, and there is not a sidewalk detour. And that particular stretch, the car detour takes you into a weird, not grid neighborhood. So you can't just take a right, left, right, and then you're on track for where you are. Like, you get lost in the middle of trees, and then you're like, there's a queue of cows. Oh, where was I supposed to be going? Like, it's really confusing back there. And if you're on a bike or on foot or on some personal mobility device, just forget it. So I would love to see wayfinding for detours for means of getting around other than cars, just a standard part of our road construction projects in ways that they don't seem to be right now.
Yes. More sidewalks, more safe routes for people, even during construction. Yes to all of those things. And I think that wraps up the agenda for today. And now I'm going to hand it back to Jess for a minute.
Yeah, I wanted to do a little pod keeping. I wanted to follow up with you listeners and thank everybody who filled out our survey that we had live this spring. We read every single response, including the ones that told us the parts that we set up the form wrong. We went in and fixed it, so thank you. But I just wanted to thank you. Your feedback was so enormously useful and interesting. One of the great parts about this podcast is that the three of us sit up here with our, you know, dogs and children and microphones, and we just talk at each other, and it's great. So to have this survey as a way for you guys to talk back was super, super interesting. We liked hearing about your favorite parts of the pod. A lot of you said these council previews. So thank you. We put a lot of time into it, and I'm glad that it's useful for you. We asked what we could be doing more of or better, and you gave us some suggestions that some of them we've already implemented even before getting to this podcast, to this episode. So thank you for that. We asked if you've taken an action based on something that you've heard on the pod, and if you did, what you did. A bunch of you are writing to your city council members, or you're talking about city civics on social media in ways that you hadn't before. So it's nice to know that listening to this pod makes a difference, not just to what you know, but to what you do. You're getting informed and getting involved. It's like you're listening. It's amazing. We also asked what you wished we'd cover. And you guys, we wrote every single thing down. In fact, we're hoping to get some of your ideas this fall, but we loved every single thing that you said. So thank you, thank you, thank you for your ideas. We also asked you what's been your favorite episodes. And I gotta say, I was really gratified to hear it. You guys have loved the deeper dives. You liked the budget episode. You liked Healthy Streets, and you liked Master Plan and Zoning. And there were a few others that you said, but thanks. We sink a lot of prep into the materials that we bring to you guys, and the fact that it's useful to you is super, super gratifying. So thank you for that. And I just wanted to kind of give closure to that survey because it gave us a lot of really useful and fun information, and we appreciated every single compliment. So thanks for that too.
Yeah, thanks everyone. So that's it for this episode of Ann Arbor AF. Come check out our episodes and transcripts at our website, annarboraf.com. Keep the conversation going with fellow Ann Arbor AF listeners on Twitter at the A2 Council hashtag and on Facebook in the Ann Arbor Humans Who Wonk group. You can also catch co-host Michelle with council recaps and other civic goodies on WCBN.org Tuesdays, 6 a.m. to 9 a.m. And that getting up at 6 a.m. after council meetings on Monday night, I think is a real, like, I can't even
imagine. That's a flex, right?
That's dedication. That's serious dedication.
I'm mostly playing music on that show. That's what I'm mostly.
So you can like doze between times. So anyway, if you want to send us a few dollars at ko-fi.com/AnnArborAF to help us with hosting costs, we would always welcome that. And that's it. We are your co-hosts, Michelle Hughes, Jess Lita, and myself, Molly Kleinman. And thanks to producer Jack Jennings. The music, I Don't Know, by Grapes. You can reach us by email at annarboraf pod@gmail.com. Get informed, then get involved. It's your city.